In episode 60 of Tucker Center Talks, we talked to Dr. Lauren Hindman, who is currently an assistant professor in the Department of Management and Entrepreneurship at Hofstra University. She earned a bachelor's in journalism at Indiana, a master's in sport management at Drexel, and her PhD in 2021 from the Eisenberg School of Management at UMass. She carried her experiences working in the sports industry into her research that revolves around experiences of women and other marginalized individuals within sport organizations. Through her work, she really is trying to reduce underrepresentation and discrimination. She has a wide body of work examining how racism, sexism, classism, and other systems of power impact sport organizations. One of the interesting studies we talked to her about is her study on racialized hiring and firing practices in the WNBA, which is very relevant given the active coach carousel to start the 2025 season, where 8 of the 13 league teams have new head coaches. Anna and I talked to Dr. Hindman about her own experiences, her research about how women navigate the rampant sexism in sports, how research has the potential to act as consciousness raising for women, counter narratives to, quote, people don't like women's sport, unquote, and so much more. We really enjoyed our conversation. I hope that you do as well. You are listening to Tucker Center Talks with me, your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie. Let's talk. All right, let's talk. Welcome, Dr. Hindman, to Tucker Center Talks.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to get to talk about my research and share it with a wider audience.
That is what we love to do on Tucker Center Talks. So Anna and I are going to sort of rotate who asks you what question. But before we get to digging into the meat of your research, how did you get to where you are now? We don't need, you know, like when I was 3, but just, you know, like an overarching, what was your career trajectory?
Yeah. So when I finished my undergrad, I had zero intention of any additional higher education. I didn't think I would do a master's or anything. I did my master's in sport management a few years into my career because I wanted to work in sports. I was working in marketing and really wanted to shift into the sports space. And I was able to do that. I started working in minor league baseball and then in hockey and did that for, I think, about 9 seasons between the two sports. And that was really when I started thinking about my PhD. I had a little bit of an interest in teaching while I did my master's. I thought that might be something I would do on the side in the future and didn't think I'd do the PhD. It just didn't seem like an option to me. I also really didn't have any idea what it was.
What is this thing they call the PhD? Yeah.
And my research in my master's program was focused on marketing because I wanted to work in sport marketing. So I had the opportunity to do some guest speaking while I was working in sports and get to know some professors and found myself having the conversation a couple of different times within a few month period with people of like, oh yeah, you know, I would like to teach at some point. I like doing research during my master's program, but I'm never going to do the PhD. And then I finally asked myself why. If I kept saying I liked both pieces, why wouldn't I do it? And at the same time, having worked in men's pro sports in the business offices, I was starting to become very interested in the way that my work experience and the work experience of the women in my office was quite different than the men that we worked with in some ways. And we can probably talk about how that aligns with some of the research I've done later.
Yeah, that might be the understatement of the Tucker Center Talks history.
Right.
The women's experiences in sport are quite different than the men.
Quite different. And in particular, right, I was the senior director of marketing for my team, and we had a senior director of ticket sales and who was a guy, and we worked really closely together in, you know, fairly similar areas. And I remember one time just mentioning to him how literally weekly somebody would ask me how I got my job and whether I was a sports fan. And he said to me, he's like, no one has ever asked me that. No one has questioned my place. And in fact, he wasn't, we were in hockey. He's like, I'm not a hockey fan. Like, I actually am. And he wasn't, but I was the one who got questioned on it. And his belonging in that space was never questioned. And so now I had a research question, right? I had something that I wanted to look at. And that really combined with the conversations I was having made it seem feasible that, all right, I could go do this thing. And so I did the PhD. I went to UMass. My first job out of the PhD was at a small teaching school. And I was there for about 2 years before I transitioned to Hofstra University, where I'm at now.
Awesome. Well, you are one of many distinguished guests we've had from the UMass Eisenberg School of Management and the Mark H. McCormick Department of Sport Management. We love talking to all of you because you're doing such great work collectively and individually. And I think what strikes me about you have a really rich body of research already for someone who's early on in their career. But I think overall, and it seems to lend itself to your experiences, you not only are a scholar, you've lived this in the workplace, which is really unique. Because most of us have never had any real world experience. So you can bring in both. And we are, and I'm saying this on every episode lately, is Tucker Center Talks is a safe space for unapologetic me-searchers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So welcome.
Thank you. Yeah.
And so when you study like the sport as a gendered workplace in general as one piece. So that we're going to talk about that. But just before we dive into that, what does that mean, sport as a gendered workplace?
Yeah, so really that theory of gendered organization, it stems from Joe Acker's work in the early 1990s and into the early 2000s on gendered organization theory. And it's this idea that rather than looking at individuals in workplaces. So we're thinking about, you know, men and women at work. And a lot of our gender research in sport, right, does that. It talks to women about their experiences, or it talks to men and it maybe compares. Gendered organization theory kind of backs up to think about the organization itself and understanding that it's not just men and women who are bringing their gender to work, but that organizations are actually constructed on ideas about gender, right? They're constructed on our social understandings of gender and gender roles. And so we have gendered structures in organizations. We've got gendered practices in organizations and a lot of different ways that that interacts together. And in particular, you know, a lot of what I am thinking about is power and privilege in organizations and those structures and practices are how that happens. And so that's really the basis of my gendered organization work.
So Lauren, diving a bit deeper into your research and kind of on that thread of work that you do around women's experiences in the workplace, I would love to know from your research, how do you feel, also from your experience, how are women navigating these gendered organizations and these workplaces filled with rampant sexism?
Yeah. So in the study in Journal of Sport Management that I did looking at women in men's pro sport organizations specifically and their experiences of sexism, we found these ways that they are responding to it and navigating it. And there's different strategies that they can take. A lot of times what it comes down to for the ones that persist often seems to be that they minimize it, right? That they kind of pretend it's not happening to them. One of the things that struck me the most in that study was the way we designed the study is we did an initial interview and then we asked women to journal for 2 weeks about their experiences. And then they submitted their journals and we did another interview. And when they emailed me their journals, more than half of them probably said something like, not much to report, but then they would have a handful to a dozen instances in just a 2 week period of things that they noticed, right?
Oh, wow.
And to them, that's not much to report. So sometimes it's minimizing it. It's also, I think, partially a taking it on as kind of a badge of honor that look at me, look how strong I am. I can put up with this. Which is great. And I'm sure I was that way too when I was in that space. But I worry about what that does in terms of the women who don't persist, right? Because that gives that they're weak, or that it's their fault that they couldn't persist. And it does nothing to actually change the culture, right? It doesn't do anything to address the problem. And so that's what I see happening, is that combination of minimizing how much you're experiencing it or how bad it is, and also just putting up with it and taking it on as a badge of honor.
Which is so interesting. I mean, the cost, the organizational cost of losing talent because they don't persist, or the personal individual cost to the person's health and well-being, their job satisfaction, their performance, all the energy that has to go to negotiating and navigating this constant sexism and gender bias in the workplace, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
And I don't even think the women know that.
Yeah. Well, and one of the thing that's stood out to me so clearly really started in that Journal of Sport Management piece, which was my very first author publication, and also initiated as a paper in my very first semester of my PhD program. It was a class paper.
Okay, Lauren. Okay.
So that you know was a very meaningful paper for me in a lot of reasons. But both that work and in my dissertation work, one of the things that's particularly become apparent to me is the challenges for women working in sports sales. And we know in these revenue-focused sport organizations that those sales departments are the largest, right? That's where most of the employees are. That's where we tell our students that they should think about working, because there's the most job opportunity. The amount of disadvantage that women in sports sales face, because what we see happening are these judgments that they're facing, not only from their colleagues, but also from fans, that make it harder for them to sell, on top of the then navigating and dealing with all of the emotions and repercussions and everything else. These are commission-based jobs. Mm. If fans aren't approaching them at the concourse because they feel more comfortable going to a guy, or they're questioning that the woman knows what she's doing, that's affecting their actual income, not even just general job performance. And so I see all these different ways that the cards are stacked against women in sports sales, even though in a lot of ways in other industries, it's been written about how sales has become kind of a feminized profession in certain respects. But in sports, there's a lot, again, kind of a lot interacting structurally as well, where women are underrepresented in those departments, particularly in non-service oriented roles. And then they're faced with this sexism from both colleagues and bosses and fans that's really stacking against them.
So just let me ask you, because not all our listeners might know what these women are selling. What are they selling? Tickets, suites, sponsorships, all the above? What does that mean?
Yeah, generally, from an entry-level position, it's going to be a ticket sales position. And so you're selling season tickets and group tickets generally. And then in the sponsorship side of things, the entry-level employees on the sponsorship side tend to be in more coordinator service-oriented roles. And then there are sales positions as well that are selling the sponsorships for the team and the games and so forth.
So, Lauren, my question next is one, I think, to you're doing such important work on this type of thread of not just counting how many women there are in these fields. I think there's so much work and there's been so much discourse lately, especially that's important to say women are underrepresented in sport leadership positions and sport sales, for example, and all these types of levels of different sport organizations. But I think what your work fills in the gap is says, well, yes, that question is important of how many women and gender minorities and gender diverse people are in these roles, but how are they actually experiencing these very masculine, sexist climates? So I want to know from your research, what recommendations do you have for sport organizations to help support women and diverse peoples in these spaces that go beyond just saying, add more women, that's going to work.
Yeah, I'm glad you pulled that out of all of my research, because I think it's an important thread. And even in my work looking at occupational segregation, right, where we literally are kind of looking at the numbers, we're thinking more specifically about beyond just the leadership hierarchy, what types of roles are these women filling? So I think I would say to me, it's an entire employee life cycle question. And so I think that organizations, one, they need to be thinking, of course, about how they're recruiting. They need to be thinking about hiring and where they're hiring women into. And again, beyond just leadership positions, but as I mentioned, are you hiring women in sales? If they're in sales, are they actually selling or are they in service-oriented positions? Because those service positions don't have as much power or kind of career trajectory, promotional advancement opportunity. So thinking about those types of questions, what departments and roles are you hiring women into? Then looking at the actual employee experience and the culture, one of the pieces I'm writing now based off of my dissertation work is specifically looking at organizational rituals and the way these kind of daily practices that we build into our organization that we maybe think about as being gender neutral aren't necessarily.
So give me an example. I'm so curious about this. What? Give me one that pops up.
So for my dissertation, I shadowed, I did field work in two men's pro teams in their front offices. And at one of the teams, their sales department had a daily golf putting competition where based on the number of sales calls they made that morning, they got to take golf putts down the hallway to win a prize. And all of the men in the department who they were all men except for one woman. All of them took it super seriously. They all golfed together outside of work. And the one woman didn't. And she would wait until all the guys had taken their turns and turned back to their work. And then she goes up. She goes to like the furthest thing. She just takes a putt really hard and long and, you know, not using proper form. I mean, the guys were literally adjusting their stances and pointing out the lines in the carpet that they should do like they were on the green. And she just, you know, kind of takes it very nonchalantly. She walks back to her cubicle. She's literally swinging the putter. And she turned to me and she said, as you can tell, I do not play golf. And we know we've got all this research on how golf is very masculinized and is used as a way of excluding women in business in a lot of cases. And here's this way that it's being brought not even to the out of the office networking, but literally to the in-office experience. Seem maybe minor and not a big deal, but just one example of something that becomes ritualized and it's part of the overall culture and can have a real effect, right? That ritual in particular, it's supposed to motivate them to sell more. Who's it motivating? If she doesn't care about it, is it motivating her, right? Really paying attention to that stuff.
Yeah.
And then the last piece, just to go back to the life cycle, the last piece is the firing, right? The retention component. I think we'll probably talk about the WNBA coaches article in this conversation. That's one piece where we looked at this. Another piece of my dissertation looks at what happens when organizations downsize. And in both of those cases, right, we see how women, and in the case of the WNBA, racial minorities are disadvantaged. And so really paying attention to how are downsizing and firing decisions being made, because potentially there's bias built into that system there. Again, even if it's not intentional, something's going on.
Right. I think that's a great segue to that exact WNBA conversation. Of course, as anyone who's a fan of women's sports or even remotely interested in sports, the WNBA has had a huge moment this season, record-breaking viewership, attendance, and just more and more eyeballs on the WNBA. And then after the season ended, a lot of controversy and news surrounding a lot of firings of coaches, particularly women coaches of color. And your article from a few years ago actually discussed this exact topic of racial and gender discrimination in coach firing.
Yeah.
And I'd love to know if you can give us just kind of the highlights of the findings that you had from this study and how it might inform what's happening today.
Yeah. So in that study, we looked at the first, I think at the time, it might've been 24, 25 seasons of the WNBA. And every time that a coach had been fired, right, recording their race and their gender. And we were also able to capture information about team performance. How long has the coach been there? Does the coach have playing history prior to being a coach? How long had the team existed in that market? So we had all of this data that we could use to control in the study. And Dave Barry out of Southern Utah, he's the brains behind the method on this piece. He's an economist. And
wait, before we go further, let's just do a small shout out to Dave Barry and Neff Walker's new book.
Yes.
Slaying the Trolls. I have it, and I'm like just a chapter in, but it's on my reading list. Awesome book for anybody that wants like counter data based counter narratives to all the BS of what we hear about of why people don't like women's sport. And
yeah,
so just sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to do a quick PSA for their book.
Absolutely. A great book, a great message in that book. I think all of us who work in this space and teach in this space, I know every time that I do a SWOT analysis of the WNBA with my undergraduate students, at least one student is going to come out and say that their weakness is that they don't dunk. And so to have something that I can point to and say, stop saying that, like here's what the research actually tells us about why people like women's sports or why they don't, and how it's not based on an inferiority of the product, but it's based, quite frankly, on, you know, boiling it down to sexism and gender ideology and stereotypes. So
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So back to your WNBA study on hiring.
Yeah. So again, Dave Barry at Southern Utah does the methodology here for us. And we find that when we're controlling for performance and other factors, white women, Black women, Black men, all more likely to be fired at the end of the season than white men. And this is in the WNBA, right? This is in the league that it's women's sports, it's predominantly Black athletes, it's celebrated for their diversity and inclusion efforts. And we're seeing this happen in this space, which obviously is incredibly disappointing. Now, what our research from this particular study doesn't tell us is why, right? We don't have data on why the decisions were made specifically. And so we're missing that component in this study. This study is basically showing that it's happening.
Yep.
And so we need more research, particularly in the coaching space and in the WNBA, to understand that. That type of data is difficult to get, right? That's not publicly available data, right? We can find generic statements, but they generally aren't going to give a lot of information about why a firing decision is made.
Even if they do have a book like, oh, we thank Coach X for his or her time at said team, you know, doesn't tell the story of you're fired.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like what even what we can find in publicly available media is not even accurate.
Exactly. And so when we think about that, like, what does that mean? What can we conclude from that? If we don't know the why, what we know is the pattern. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at things that happened since, as we did on this current offseason, we can say, hey, this is additional data to a pattern that we already established existed.
And was it the same pattern that you saw this season as the other 24 seasons?
I don't know that we've looked specifically, crunched the numbers on this season. We there was one particular instance when the Chicago Sky let go of their coach that was very publicly discussed even before we brought our research into the fray.
And that's Teresa Witherspoon, for those who are following along or might not know, who's a Hall of Famer, African-American woman, very decorated, coached one season at the Sky, did pretty well, even with some injuries, but then got let go.
Yeah. And, you know, Angel Reese, who was, you know, standout rookie, who's on that team, was very upset about the decision. A lot of the media in Chicago and elsewhere were really questioning it because, hey, you bring somebody in, you give them one season when they're supposed to be rebuilding a team, right? This wasn't bringing somebody into an already high-performing team that you're expecting to continue to have that same level of success. The purpose was to rebuild and to only give them a season. And so we brought our data into that conversation to just say, hey, this follows a pattern we've seen previously where maybe non-white men aren't being given the same opportunity to fail, right? Or to have the longevity to succeed in a longer term. So yeah, we haven't necessarily looked at how that data played out statistically across the entire league for this particular season. When you have such a small number of teams, it's really hard to look at just one season because
yeah, we don't have enough.
One firing of one person, like, right, there's just not enough data to make it statistically significant, which is why our study looked at the entire history of the league.
Right, which is such a great data set. And I'm just, you know, I don't know, just from a fan perspective, and obviously someone who studies women's sport, I was really surprised on how many coaches got fired and got reorged in the league, given what Anna said is the league had unprecedented eyeballs and success. And I'm wondering if because of that, now there's more scrutiny, more on the line, more money, more power that franchises want to get it right. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, again, I'm not sure how it plays out if we compared the number of firings to previous seasons. We'd have to look at it. I mean, I think one thing, as you said, that it made me think about that I hope won't come to fruition, but we know from your research and your data, we know what's happened in the NCAA as women's sports became more important to institutions. We know that led to a decrease in women coaching. And so I hope that we don't see that happen with the increased popularity of the WNBA, but it'll be definitely something we want to keep an eye on, I think, across women's sports, as, you know, it's not just the WNBA that's exploded the past few years. We're seeing it across all sorts of places in women's sports.
Yeah, something to keep track of for sure. So real quick, and you alluded to this before, but give us one thing you're working on right now that you're super excited about.
Yeah, so definitely that rituals chapter that I mentioned.
Okay.
And I gave the one example. And so really what this research is looking at is the idea of organizational rituals, which are practices that become part of organizational culture. They communicate meaning. They communicate what's valued in organizations. They're ways of communicating organizational membership through participation in rituals. And so in this particular piece, I'm looking at three different rituals that I observed and learned about during my field work. We talked about the golf putting contest as an example of that with the ticket sales department. There was also a planking competition that the staff would, in the middle of the day, get down on the ground and do a plank for a minute.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that they were going to see who could hold the plank the longest, that it was a contest.
Yeah, I thought it might be too. I had to ask. I actually participated in it with them because they're like, they asked me to, and I was like, okay. But I was the only woman.
Yeah.
Good ethnographer.
Yeah, I was the only woman. I had, the ethnographer, like basically internal debate of, do I participate or do I just stand here and watch them?
Watch them stand over them while they plank. Yeah.
Decided it would be less awkward if I participated. So, and that, you know, I this may or may not make the final article, but it definitely made my longer dissertation chapter version of it. But I literally kind of capture my own embodied experience of that, right? Of being concerned, like, what if I can't hold it for a minute? So those two examples, the golf putting and the planking, were the two masculine rituals that I talk about. And I look at how they signal a privileging of masculinity and of men in the organization. And they don't explicitly exclude women, but women either don't participate or are marked as different. And also certain types of men might not participate, right? If you're not necessarily meeting an athletic body type, for example. So there's a specific type of masculinity that's valued. And then the third ritual I look at is actually a ritual of femininity.
Oh, say more.
Yeah, one of the organizations, they created a weekly ritual where they would get together and talk about last night's episode of The Bachelor. And this was something that happened at work. It was created by a senior woman in the office to try to bond with the younger women in the office. And it works from that regard. It creates bonding, it creates community between these women. But what ends up happening is that the men formed a counter ritual where they went to the chief revenue officer's office at the same time to talk about hockey. And the men in the office also kind of make derisive comments about the bachelor meeting, even though some of them watch the show and place bets on the show. So really the crux of my article is looking at, okay, we have these two masculinity rituals that endorse masculinity, privilege masculinity in men. And then we have this ritual of femininity that it does some things, but it doesn't privilege femininity. It doesn't give them more power or privilege in the organization. And in fact, it's met with derision, it's met with resistance, and a counter ritual actually forms in response.
Love it.
Yeah, so that's what I'm working on. I'm excited to kind of keep developing it to get that published hopefully soon.
I mean, here's the thing about research for people that think research is boring. It's so interesting because you literally cannot make that up. You cannot make it up that the women go over here and talk about The Bachelor and the men are over here making fun of the women and talking about hockey.
Yeah.
Like, that is just the most gendered thing I've ever heard of. And the fact that this happens in a workplace for good reason, like the motivation of why we're doing this is well-intentioned.
Right.
But the result is that it just ends up reproducing the status quo.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was when I presented my dissertation on Zoom because it was COVID. The faculty members from my department were literally in the comment section, like, do they ever work at these places? Because I didn't really write about the work, right? I did this,
right? Like, these workplaces,
they're planking and golfing, and
I did this study of gendered organization, and I'm talking about how they dress, and I'm in another chapter, I'm talking about these rituals in this chapter. And so they're like, where's the work? Like, what's going on in these workplaces? But if you've worked somewhere, if you've worked in an office setting where you're there, you know, 40, I shouldn't say 40, right? 60, 70 hours a week in sports, you know, there's a lot of time where things other than work are happening. And that was more interesting to me, right? In a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Well, we'll look forward to seeing that article in print.
Yes.
I have a quick follow-up question based on all the things that you've shared with this ethnographic study that you've done, the study on where you had women do the diary entries and interviews and things like that. Do you feel that when you're talking to women in the workplace like this, and you gave the example at the beginning of our conversation where these women would be like, nothing to report, but then share these like 30 examples of sexist things that happened to them. Do you feel that through your interaction with these folks, that there's some sort of consciousness raising around becoming aware of the sexism that is happening to them?
And is that good or bad?
Yeah, just like, what are your thoughts on research as a way to consciousness raise?
I mean, I think it's good. I definitely think so. I've had participants say at the end of an interview that they feel like it was like a therapy session. I've definitely had participants say when I ask a question, oh, I've never thought about that before. So I do think from a conscious raising perspective, that's definitely happening. I mean, I get the view that is it good to raise it? Because obviously, if we're thinking on it and we're dwelling on it, we know that that can be negative psychologically for women. But as I said, one of the strategies seems to be this minimization. And if we're minimizing that it's happening to us, we're not going to be applying any pressure for things to change.
Right. Like, how do you use that to intervene on the system?
Yeah.
And change the culture. Yeah. Because nothing's happening to change the system. Women are just having to figure it out and exist in a system that is not valuing and supporting them.
Yeah. And the challenge, and I don't have an answer for this yet, other than I keep saying it, is that the challenge is that, like, yes, we need women to speak up. We need women to put this pressure on for change. But I'm also always concerned with the fact that even that is kind of putting the onus on women to fix the problem.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, and again, that goes back to what we talked about earlier with just adding more women doesn't fix the problem. But even if we do add the women in the leadership roles, are we then saying we have to have women in leadership roles in order to fix it? Because they're the only ones who can fix it. Like, part of this is that we need the men to recognize as well that this is a problem that needs to be fixed, that needs to be addressed, and that needs to be addressed proactively and not as a response of a woman coming to you saying something's happened to her.
And I think even to add on to that before we start wrapping this up is even Anna and I are looking at some data on using a gender bias lens to look at workplace experiences of women sport coaches. And, you know, the same patterns arise. Like we thought we would find a lot more gender bias, but in fact, we don't. But then the Queen Bee Syndrome, which is one of the subscales, came out. And even when women do get in positions of leadership, we know from the research that they often, you know, adopt the style of leadership that is most valued in that organization, what happens to align with men and masculinity and gendered leadership styles, which then disadvantages the women that are below them. So it's like this is a really tough problem to solve unless the men at the top and the women at the top are aware of this, and how do they change the gendered structure of the workplace? So when you figure this out, Lauren, we'll have you back on and we'll say we have solved the problem on Tucker Center Talks.
Yeah. Maybe the this podcast will get into the right ears, right? And
We can always hope. All right, Anna, wrap her up.
yeah. So I am really curious about what some of the best pieces of advice that you've received that are really great for also other young scholars in this field.
Yeah, I think my advice, and I think this would be something that my PhD advisor certainly was good at doing with me, is finding the right people to work with and to just have as community, you even beyond the people that you write and research with. This is a profession that can sometimes feel a little isolating. A lot of the work we do on our own, right? We teach our own classes, we do our own research. And especially when we're researching in spaces related to diversity type issues on gender and race and sexuality, these are spaces that can feel even more isolating, I think, a lot of times in our institutions. I've been at my two academic jobs so far, the only sport management person on the faculty. So that also kind of adds to it. So finding community of people you can connect with. I mentioned to you all before we started the recording that I have a virtual writing group with some folks from around the country now that we write with, and have that space where we can connect and also be working at the same time. So I think that's really important to me. And I also think envisioning what success looks like for you. I had a lot of questions coming out of my PhD program about what kind of job I wanted to have and what I wanted to accomplish and where would be a good fit for me. And I think that often, if we are success oriented, you know, kind of high achievement oriented, we might be automatically thinking that means it has to be at an R1 institution. And I have not found that that's where I want to be. I've found that I can find other types of institutions where I can still be a successful researcher and also be a successful teacher, and find some kind of balance, and really having to kind of define for myself what that means success in my career looks like, because the model we get in our PhD programs, because those programs are at R1 schools, is based on the R1 model. And I think especially for us as women, and I think this should be true for everyone, but societally it's often more so true for women, you know, thinking about where a career fits into our overall lives and how do you make that work. And certainly you can do that at an R1 institution, but you can also do that elsewhere.
Yeah.
I love that advice, Lauren, because not only finding your community, but then really thinking about what is the context where I think I can be most successful. And a lot of it's like, oh, the R1 research is the end all be all. It's kind of like when women coaches who are successful in the women's game is like, oh, you should coach the men. That's the end all be all. It's like that is not true for everyone. So I think giving yourself permission to take a step back and go, is that really what I want to do or not, is really great advice. Okay, so we're going to wrap this up with three speed round questions. No right or wrong answer. First thing that pops into your head. What is at the top of your playlist right now?
I am still in my Taylor Swift era. So I just
Yes.
have Taylor Swift on shuffle. It's also holiday season right now, and I'm a big Straight No Chaser fan, which is an a cappella group out of my undergrad alma mater, Indiana. So I'm always streaming Straight No Chaser at the holiday season.
I didn't know you were a Hoosier.
Yeah.
Go Big Ten,
Yep.
which is now when I say Big Ten, it seems really false. I'm just going to call it like the Big 50.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think I still haven't adjusted all of my slides to referring to the number of power conferences this year. I realized like halfway through the semester, I'm like saying Power Five doesn't work anymore.
Nope. It's really blown our women in college coaching report card out of the water because there's no Pac-12. So we got to figure that out. That's a problem for Anna to solve when she's not
Yay.
writing her doctoral prelims. Okay, I know I'm not, I shouldn't joke about that. It's very serious. Okay. Okay, question two of the speed round. Who is your favorite badass woman right now?
I think Simone Biles. I just love the way that she has made a comeback. She really has done a lot in terms of speaking up around mental health and making the space for more conversations in that regard, which I think is very important. And, is somebody who is taken an Olympic sport, right? A sport that people only pay attention to every 4 years on a mass scale and made it, I think, relevant every year, which is really impressive to me.
Okay, last question on the speed round. Who is a woman scholar who has been very influential in your own work?
So, probably not a surprise that I'm going to say Neff Walker here. Neff was my PhD advisor, and we continue to collaborate on work even as she moves on to bigger and bigger administrative duties in the world of the University of Massachusetts. She is somebody who, to me, not just in terms of research, but in terms of who she is as a person and as a scholar, she is someone who I've gotten to witness lift up other people, including people who she was not directly responsible for, like she was for me, people at other institutions who are coming up through the pipeline. She also was deeply supportive of me at a personal level as I did my PhD program and navigated health challenges at the same time. And I think she's just someone who puts people first, and that's not super common in academia. And she takes that in all of her roles, whether she's teaching, researching, or doing her administrative work.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Neff Walker, if you listen to this, we love you in the Tucker Center. We've had Neff be a guest on the Distinguished Lecture Series on the podcast. I'm a super big fan of her work, and I don't see her enough because she's very busy, and as we all are. So, Lauren, thanks again for being a part of Tucker Center Talks, and we appreciate your work. Keep up the good work. And that is a wrap for this episode of Tucker Center Talks. Be sure to check out our many free evidence-based resources on our website at tuckercenter.org and follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram. This podcast was produced by Tucker team member Lindsay Hofer. Thank you, Lindsay. And thank you for listening to Tucker Center Talks. As we wrap, give yourself grace, support others, and let the data tell the story in ways that help us all accelerate systems change for girls and women in sport. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie,
and I'm Anna Gorbich,
signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.